This week on Cider Chat, it is part two of the Beginner Cider Makers Q&A, pre-recorded at CiderCon 2019. This is episode 175, and you are listening to Cider Chat. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I produce NMC, this weekly podcast where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks in the cider trade from around the world. We'll be coming up with a part two of that Q&A, but first, a wee bit of news out and about in Ciderville. I think I was starting out to be a cider podcaster at an early age because my mom always used this term, I love you a bushel and a peck. And I was just maybe that farming kind of lifestyle. It seems that anyone who grew up in New England, my spot of Ciderville in the USA, most of us have roots in a farming heritage because that's how not too long ago people survived here. Large families, some a little farm one way or the other, and certainly my family on both sides of the coin, both parents, no different. They had, you know, they're out picking potatoes, had different crops, apple trees, pear trees, the whole nine yards. And these little phrases like a bushel and a peck. And that is that little kind of seed that gets planted in one's brain, and you don't know where it's going to lead you and takes you to this point of being a cider podcaster, which is what I do. And now we are at 175 episodes. That's over 175 hours, because if you add on a little bit here or there, some extra bonus content, that is a lot of time. So let's do the math. There are 24 hours in a day, and there are 7 days per week. At 175 episodes, I have now produced enough cider content that you could listen nonstop for an entire week. And I know some of you are out there cruising and you're doing these like long road trips, and you have done this like straight out Cider Chat road tour, which is so awesome. Absolutely awesome. In the context of a content that is now out there with, I don't know how many countries, I mean, I'm going to say 16, 17 countries, nearly every state in the U.S., parts of the Southern Hemisphere, and definitely in the Northern Hemisphere, that is a lot of content, Ciderville. That is a lot. That's a lot of content. And you know, the interesting thing about a podcast, it's both blogging, so there's always show notes, and I pride myself in offering up good show notes, you know, the contact info for all the people on there. And then you have this audio piece that you get to download and listen to at your own leisure. The beauty of the podcast is that you could kind of keep on going back 15 seconds, depending on what app you're using, and going over that piece, critical info. I do it all the time with my favorite podcasts. I listen to podcasts on podcasting so I could deliver you a better service. And some of the recent episodes we had, if you don't know about them, you should definitely know. Going back to episode 168 with Ryan Monkman, that was Barrel Aging Cider Inspiration, where he just goes through a magnificent amount of info on oak, its use with cider, the flavors that it lends. There's bonus content now, about 40 minutes plus of bonus content up on the Cider Chat Patreon page. That is a page I use to help support this podcast, so people sign up to do a monthly donation. And then there's also Is a Cider in Your Cup Dry or Sweet? That was a recent CiderCon recording with the New York Cider Association doing a dry scale. Then recently, bringing you inside a look at one of the world's most renowned cider makers, Eric Bordelais in Normandy, France, taking you on a tasting at his domain. That was like a two-part piece, the cider tasting with Eric Bordelais. And then there was a bonus piece where Bordelais talked about everything from pressing the juice to bottling it. That's up on the Patreon page. And then recently, a fantastic discussion with my friend Lee Reeve of Insider Japan, the first and only bilingual magazine in Japan on all things ciders. In Japan, it's something you should definitely subscribe to. Keep it on your bookshelf. Links in the show note. And then last week, we had that first part of the beginner's cider making question and answer period, a five panel discussion that we're going to get to coming right up.
You gotta grab that luchi. You gotta bust that thang. Get your kicks on the street. Gotta kick back, step back. Oh, you gots to skeet. It's a rat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat-a-bala. Rat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat-a-rat-a-tat-a-holla. I don't wanna be pushed like I do the push. When it comes to the cheddar, keep it under the cushion. I don't wanna be ganked like I do the gank. When it comes to the cake, beat me, you think. I don't wanna be pushed like I do the push. When it comes to the cheddar, keep it under the cushion. I don't wanna be ganked like I do the gank. When it comes to the cake, beat me, you think.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, now we are ready to head into the second part of the beginner cider making Q&A, pre-recorded at CiderCon 2019. There were five panelists. If you want to listen to part one, just go back an episode to episode 174, and you could hear the full intro for the panelists. But in the meanwhile, let me give you a little bit of a setup if you're kind of new to this discussion. CiderCon is the annual trade conference put on by the United States Association of Cider Makers. It took place in Chicago at the tail end of January, actually the first week of February 2019. I was narrating or kind of moderating this discussion. The five panelists were up in front, as was I, and then there was a microphone down in the audience, and so you'll hear each person asking a question, introducing themselves. On the panel, we had Marcus Robert from Titan Ciderworks in Washington, Tim Godfrey from Golden State Cider in California, Eleanor Leger of Eden Specialty Cider in Vermont, and Brent Miles of Sly Clyde Cider in Virginia, and Ben Calvi of Vermont Cider Company in Vermont. In part one, in episode 174, these are some of the topics that were covered, such as how to describe what is cider to people. Also, I asked the panelists to talk about the classic, if you knew then what you know now, what would that be? That was pretty interesting. From the audience, we had breweries getting to cider, managing residual sugar in the bottle for packaging, can you use sulfites, the challenge for small cider makers, and that's a business approach, the downfall of potassium sorbate in the natural market, contract fermenting, iCider, went over a number of different things there. If you're using a freezer, are you cheating? Stabilizing iCider and yeast strains for iCider. And in this week, we're going to be covering plastic versus stainless for fermenting or storing cider. Can you make money being a commercial maker? What are the best cider styles to offer? Do you need three core products or eight core products to offer? Where to locate a cidery? Should you take out a loan when going full into cider making, or perhaps use Kickstarter? What is the most crucial piece of lab equipment to have starting out? And best fermentation temperatures? And there might have been a little bit more in between. So let's head straight to the beginner cider making Q&A with a question from a maker in Canada.
Hi, I'm Marcus. I'm from Canada as well. I have a cidery up there. Just wondering, we're pretty new and pretty small, so I've heard or seen on the internet some people will use plastic instead of stainless steel in fermentation or storage. I was wondering your opinion on that.
Yeah, it's cheap and totally fine to use, like IBCs or flex tanks. The only problem ends up being temperature control, which is very important. And some of the, I can't remember the brand, but there's some that have like a no glycol cooling system that you can buy. But in terms of the actual like material, it's totally fine to use, and a lot of cider makers do that. But I would just caution, like don't just, unless it's really cold ambient temperature, you are going to get a lot of heat spikes from the exothermic part of the fermentation. And so just whatever you can do if you're ambient fermenting in an IBC, like if you have a walk-in, sometimes I'll start it at ambient, bring it to the walk-in overnight, and it kind of cools it down, and then I pull it back out, and to kind of keep it as steady as you can. But it's hard to get consistent products unless you're doing the temperature control. But
thank you.
Another comment I would add is just make sure your sanitation is really good. The totes are a wonderful, cheap way to ferment, but it's hard to clean the top corners after you ferment. So invest in some good yoga classes and also some brushes and things, and adapt a few ways so you can do CIPs with pumps and stuff. So get creative about really making sure you clean the plastic. Otherwise, it's a great affordable way to start.
And the last thing is not good for storage. Like fermentation's okay. Fine, but you don't want to store cider in them.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Bill Sussman. I'm with Cold Spring Cider Works in Cold Spring, New York, on the Hudson River. We're just starting out, and so this is a general question. I used to make wine. They said the way to make a small fortune in the wine business is to start with a large fortune. So I'm wondering, in cider, can you make money? Is it profitable? And is there an ideal point? Is there an ideal amount of production or something that you say, you're going to struggle until you hit this point, and then maybe there's a sweet spot? I don't know, but I'm just asking the question.
So I write a blog, or at least I used to. I haven't done it in a while, called Cidernomics, which is sort of all the sort of analysis you need to think about to answer those questions for yourself based on where you're located and what your apple sources are and what kind of cider you want to make. Because all three of those things really impact the answers to those questions. There's no blanket answer.
It really depends on what you want your business to be. Most of the time I'm talking to people wanting to start up a business, and they're already talking with distributors and trying to sign contracts and before they even really have a product made. And at the end of the day, most of my tips are basically stay as small as possible for as long as possible. If you think you're going to sign up a distributor and conquer the world, it doesn't really happen that way. I mean, you're putting in, if you have a distributor or you sign up a distributor, you're signing a contract to do more work yourself, because you're still going to be the salesperson. You're not there. They are a warehouse that happens to have delivery trucks at the end of the day, and they will service accounts the way they're supposed to be serviced. But distributors have thousands of SKUs of products, and their salespeople on the street sell usually the top 10 products in that book, because they're trying to bring home money to their family on incentive. Unless for somehow your little company can get on their incentive sheets, so it's very complex, and a lot of cideries get to the point where they sign up with a distributor, they start selling some volume. Then it becomes a vicious cycle of, well, if I sell more volume to make up for the margin that I give the distributor, then I have to buy more, I have to do more CapEx, and I have to go to the bank to get another loan to do more CapEx, and then I got to sell more cider, and then it keeps rotating that way. And you get to a point, when you get to about, let's say, a medium-sized cider, it's kind of a scary point, because you're giving up a lot of margin to the distributor, you're having to produce more volume, you're having to buy more equipment to be more efficient or produce more cider, and that's where a lot of cideries fail, breweries fail, wineries fail, is at that medium size, because they can't quite get to the point. What's that? Well, they can't quite get to the point where their EBITDA is positive, and so the bank doesn't like seeing a negative EBITDA or a balance sheet for very long before they go, well, you got to get this thing positive or we have to call your note. So staying as small as possible for as long as possible. If you want to sell, if you have a good retail location, make your retail location sell as much of your product as possible to get the full retail for it. Start up other retail locations. Sell as much of the product as you can yourself to retail. And that's...
which speaks to location.
Yeah. And it's... we, as Titan Ciderworks, we've never had a really good location. We still sell a lot of product out of our door, but we're heavily entrenched in distribution. And I understand that world a lot better now. So, yeah, stay. I mean, it's you'll make a fine, if you do it right, you'll make a fine living staying small. But if you're going out trying to conquer the world with a brand and having it sold to Coors or Budweiser or Heineken or somebody else, that's also a very hard thing to do. So that's my two cents.
Okay, thank you very much.
One more comment from Ben.
So advice I got when I started making wine was don't learn how to do it with your own money. It's go get a job for somebody. I love the entrepreneurial spirit of Americans and small business owners, but if you've never worked in the trade at all, go work at a tap room, at a bar room, for a distributor, go work for a cider maker. Learn everything you need to know with someone else paying you, because they're worrying about the business decisions. Once you have that knowledge and you think, okay, I want to take all this skill and expertise that I've got for the last 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, then start your company. That would be my advice.
So my name is Kyle. I'm a home cider maker, cider enthusiast. I've been making cider for a little, about 3 years. And eventually, I would like to have a small retail location. That's kind of like the end game for me. I don't really want to, you know, I don't want to get too big. So with that in mind, if I were going to do this, I would make, you know, cider that I think is good, that other people give good feedback on. What is like an ideal number of different cider styles to have starting out? Like, I would make a dry tannic cider, and I would love that, and I would want everyone to love it, but I understand that not everybody loves that. So I recognize the importance of having, you know, other styles, you know, a little sweeter or maybe something with a fruit component. So do you have a recommendation on, you know, do you have 3, 4 core ciders, or, you know, do you go for 8, or is there a magic number, or not really?
That's a good question. We have 4 core ciders, okay. And then we have a few different other series that we do. This is how we do it. We have 4 core ciders, and we have 2 series. We have a limited release series, and we also have a single varietal series. And that gives our customer a sense of what's new coming out in the market. Because the thing is, you don't want too much at one time, because you confuse right. The consumer. They've had studies, let's say studies in Costco, where they put out 20 different jams, and you taste 20 different jams and you walk away with none of them because you can't remember which one was the best. And then they've had studies, they compare that to studies with 4 jams, and they taste 4 jams, they go, they buy something like 60% more jam mm-hmm. if you have less choices. So altogether, we produce like 14 different varieties of cider, maybe more. I don't remember what the count is now. Mm-hmm. But we really focus our sales on 4 core items and a couple limited releases throughout the year. That's our model.
Cool. Great question.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's wise that you already realize that the cider you like might not be the cider that you need to sell. I found that out as well, and it's frustrating, but it's the reality. If you make one cider, you'll probably attract 10% of the people that might want to drink it. So. We try to do as much diversity as we can with our ciders. We're similar. We have 4 core, and then we have a couple series that highlight different things that we think are interesting and people would like to try. But having a variety, especially as you start out, is super important.
Okay. Yeah, and that's really interesting that you mentioned that too, because, you know, having like a core line, I think that makes sense, because, you know, especially as a small, you know, maker with limited resources, I'm not spreading myself too thin, trying to do, you know, too much crazy stuff and have, you know, 12 different ciders and whatever. So that's good input too. Thank you.
And I think on the retail side, in distribution, it's really important to have kind of a curated set of like 4 or 5 or 3. But on the retail side, I think what you want to balance is consistency, so people can come back and taste what they liked last time with newness and spice. And so you want people who it's their second time in and they want to try the new thing. Or so at Slackline Ciderworks, what we've been doing is we have 10 taps, 5 of them are core, and then the other 5 are. So one is like a reserve series, or 2 taps are like a reserve series, and 3 are kind of monthly rotating.
Okay.
So we do a kind of monthly release of new flavored ciders.
Okay.
And it's also dependent on the variables that you have to work with. So right. If you are just buying juice, you can't do much with different apples except for maybe a couple times a year. So you're dealing with different sweetness levels or acid levels or adding different flavors. And so don't forget that, you know, what a lot of people like are these days are flavored ciders, and you can have a really good base and make basically unlimited number of ciders from that base if you want to. But I just would, yeah. So I think on the retail side, you have a bit more flexibility to go a bit wider, but you do still want people to come back and try the thing that they liked last time.
Right.
So that they're not always like getting kind of, you know, confronted with these new flavors. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. So I'm also just starting out, and I've been really struggling with location-based questions. Right now, I've been making cider on a family farm in the middle of pretty much nowhere. And I understand from the community that, you know, having a taste room is where you can make most of your sales. But how important is it to locate your tasting room where you're actually making your product, or, you know, how do you balance urban versus bucolic experience? And has anybody ever tried both, having tasting rooms in both types of environments? I don't know if anybody has any advice about that.
People want to come see Willy Wonka Land, and they want to see where the stuff is made. But the truth of the matter is, you really need a good retail location where there's good traffic, because we did the same thing. We were out literally out in the at the end of the road, out of a community that has 1,100, maybe 700 people in it, and no one ever visited. We got like 2 people a week on average. That did not sell any retail where our highest margin is. And so if you're trying to build a business, then you have to recruit customers with the lowest price per head possible. Yeah. Trying to drag people out to a farm, which maybe you have a Disneyland of a farm out there, and you have kids crawling on trees, and you have mazes and pumpkin patches and that sort of thing. That's great. You get a lot of customers that way. But most traditional farms like mine, we don't do U-Pick. We don't do those things. So people literally had to like find us somehow. Yeah. And I think when people come out, they want to see how it's made and look at it, that's fine. But to actually have to sell as much retail as possible, it takes a lot of effort and time and money to get people out to your farm that has no other reason to come out to, rather than bringing the cider to them where they live, you know. Okay. So that's my 2 cents on it. Someone else may.
Yeah, I have a slightly different perspective. So part of it is how close are you to a major city? Because if you were easy driving distance to a major population center, mm-hmm. I would say don't open a retail center, just self-distribute. Okay. And use your place for events, for trade and press from your market. Mm-hmm. So you've got focused occasions when people can come. Or maybe just have something that's only open on Saturdays or by appointment. But retail location in an urban environment is expensive rent, expensive staff. Yep. It's a whole, you're in the retail business. Yep. Now you're in the bar business when you're trying to really focus on your cidery. Actually, mm-hmm. I mean, we're struggling this right now. Like, we've opened this taproom in Winooski, and we're like, do we want to be in the restaurant business? Yeah. Like, does that make sense for us? We're small. And it's far away from us. And so if you can self-distribute to a pretty major metropolitan area, I think that is a way of staying small. You're giving up the retail margin, but you still aren't, you don't have a distributor that you're dealing with. So you're getting a good price. And you know, you may need to have somebody who's willing to drive stuff around for you when you're right in the middle of a fermentation. But I would look at that as an option too.
Do you have any sort of brackets on what that distance might be?
We're 3 hours away from metro area.
Okay.
No one comes and visits us.
Yeah, I'm two hours away from the biggest town, which is 42,000 people. So that doesn't work either.
Okay.
I think don't forget that a retail location doesn't have to be a big thing. Like, you can buy a kegerator and have four taps and be open on the weekends or days that you're there anyways, and capture some of that margin without spending a lot of money building out a huge tap room. Like, it can just be, it can just exist in your space that you already have, and you can capture some of that.
Thanks.
Hi, it's me again, Michelle from York. My question, I took a seminar last CiderCon about the different avenues of raising funding for opening up the business. One of them was crowdfunding. Another one was finding investors. But they were great ideas, great tools, but I didn't really get any feedback of like what really worked and why. And I thought maybe quickly you can maybe share some insight on that and then help, you know, everyone kind of make a decision on their own.
Life is better when you don't borrow money, but that's not super available to everybody. I can say that I started making cider out of IBC totes and milk tanks with little baby pumps, and that's kind of how we made it happen. So we weren't borrowing money. I can't really speak towards crowdfunding because we just tried to keep everything organic as possible, but that's always when people are coming to me like, and they say, how am I going to afford this? It's like, well, you don't have to have your dream cidery when you open. You can start super, super low and grow there. And there's a lot of, I would imagine most people sitting here with me made cider in totes at some point, and that's how they got started. That's my feedback.
Thank you.
Keep your day job.
Always, right?
I'm really serious. I think like a really viable small cidery model is you have a day job. This is your passion. You do it on the evenings, on weekends, as a way of getting started. And then if it looks like it's going to go somewhere, that's awesome. But if it doesn't, you haven't killed yourself and bankrupted your home, mortgaged your home, you know, whatever.
How about like Kickstarter? I've seen like it work in the beer world. Again, I understand it's a different world, but I've seen a lot of breweries in my neighborhood, like Kickstarter and, you know, whatever the other ones were, and they've it at least gave them a step in the right direction.
I think Kickstarter's hard for a new company because I don't think you can actually provide. I think I've seen Kickstarter mostly used by existing cideries to do like taproom renovation. Instead of like raising the funding for their business to start, because in the taproom model you can say, oh, we're going to give you this merch or whatever, and I don't actually know if you can kickstart like alcohol production through their site. I'm not actually sure about that, but I've seen it mostly like RevNats did it to fund like a taproom expansion, things like that.
Okay.
I don't think any of us can advise you on that, and you should go find like look at Kickstarter and find some people who did it and talk to them.
Thank you.
But that's like part of the research to do is like pick up the phone and
you
call.
Got it. Thank you.
Howdy, folks. My name's Christian. I'm with Duluth Cider. We just started out like 3 months ago. We're fermenting in totes, conditioning in 15-barrel stainless jacketed bright tanks. Pretty small. We're looking to do some expansion. And I just had a question about lab equipment and what you find is like the most crucial piece of lab equipment that you find helps improve your product without dropping a ton of money. To paint a little more picture, I've got like a, I think it's an SA100 Vinmetrica like sulfite meter and a scale and a wine thief, and that's about it. So any advice on expanding my lab and
hydrometer and a
thermometer. We got a hydrometer
and
a thermometer.
Anything else?
I think you basically have what you need. The everything else, you're going to be looking at, if you want a piece of, a base piece of automated equipment, it's going to be starting at like 50 grand.
Yeah.
If you want something that you can put samples in and plug in, you're going to spend a lot less money just sending samples out to ETS labs something done. Yeah.
I think you want to measure your basic chemistries. Temperature, pH, get a benchtop pH meter. If you can't afford that, get pH strips. You want to measure acidity, titration equipment, very simple. You want to measure sulfites, you can get those kits. They're very cheap kits, but find a way to measure sulfites. And eventually you want to measure alcohol and CO2. So alcohol, you can get an old bibliometer from a yard sale probably somewhere, or you send something out to a lab. I don't know. Those are the basic chemistries I measure every day.
Sweet.
Those basic five chemistries.
Yeah, awesome.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Joe Ferrier, and I'm from Ficklewood. We aren't open yet, but we're looking to open in summer. In fact, I'm getting pictures of from our contractor of concrete saws and scaffolding, so it's kind of interesting. We're in Long Beach, California, which is just rides a line. We're at the end of LA County, right where Orange County starts, if anybody didn't know where that is. But yeah, so my questions, I actually had two questions that are, it's all equipment related. So one, I wanted to see if anybody had any practical experience that they could share on filtration, lenticular, cross flow, what preferences are. And the other is experience that any of you have had with using hop back systems or similar to systems with things other than and including hops. So for botanicals and things like that. So, yeah.
I for filtration, depending on your size, if you want to be moderately or kind of grow, you'll need to get cross-flow at some point. For smaller operations, I don't like recommending a lenticular unless you know how your cider filters. And so to know that and know the micron sizes of the pads or membranes that you're going to use, you would need to start with plate and frame, which is a great low-cost option. You do need to... unless you're going to do a couple passes with different coarseness, you'll need to probably do some clarification or settling, depending on your turnaround time. But so I like to recommend starting with a plate and frame if you want filtration, and then basically skipping lenticular and moving to cross flow at some point. The cross flow just aids a lot in your turnaround time. You can go straight from the fermenter to the bright tank, and you're going to just recoup a lot of the losses that you'll see from the multiple rackings and tank movements that you need for the plate and frame.
Can you just add how much a cross-flow filter costs these days?
Well, they range, but for a good one, it's like $100,000. And
just for filtering.
Yeah. But, I mean, if I like had to just do everything in totes and have one piece of equipment, I would choose a cross-flow filter, so...
You can find DE filters really cheap right now. A lot of people are moving up, so there's some small units that are available. I see them all the time. You can DE filter to
diatomaceous
earth filter over to a pad filter is something that we've done in the past. It's a nice cheap option too before you get to cross flow.
Okay.
I think it's like a small two element cross flow. You can find some of the less expensive models for around $30,000. They'll do, you're not going to do 6,000 gallons a day with it, more like 1,000 gallons a day, but there's that. The prices of plate and frames are that you'll start with are usually between $6,000 and $10,000 for a small one kind of thing, because anything that's made out of stainless steel is not moderately priced. It's always at the top end.
Yeah. Any of you guys use the hot back, the second question, or some kind of extraction?
Yeah, we use a hot back. We found it. We actually built our first one. It was super sketchy. But from there are some commercially available options there. I like it because it's super clean, and it's way easier than digging out tanks or anything if you're dry hopping or you're making any sort of added, like adjunct adds or something. Like, you know, if you use ginger, well, digging ginger out of a tank is frustrating, but trying to filter it is even more frustrating. So there are some commercially available options out there.
Cool.
And they're awesome.
Thank you.
Great.
I like using like the mesh hop bags, like from BSG or wherever, and basically just throwing them in the fermenter. If you're getting custom fermenters made, you can have them put hooks on the inside of the manway doors. And you can then hook the bags to those so you're not actually having to dig anything out. Or if you're buying wine tanks that have outswing manway doors, those are really easy on like slope bottom tanks. But then it keeps it kind of contained. You get a lot of contact time. It does affect your process because you're kind of doing separate batches as opposed to making a base cider and adding flavoring later. So it's dependent on a lot of things, but that's kind of my preferred method.
One more question.
Hi there, my name's Giff. I'm from New Hampshire. I have a small on-farm cidery for our local pick-your-own fruit farm that we run. Fermentation temperatures. Someone brought up a fermentation spike. First question is, what constitutes a spike? Is it 2 degrees? Is it 10 degrees in fermentation temperature? And second, there's always the range, temperature range on any cultured yeast. Do you guys ride the lower end of that range? Do you ride the higher end? Where have you found your best fermentation temperatures?
Low and slow. So usually whatever yeast you choose to ride the lower end of it, that's where, you know, cider aromatics are pretty delicate. They blow off really easily. So we try to keep it low and cold. We have our jacketed tank. We usually set a differential of 2 degrees, so that's clicking on. If it hits 2 degrees above or below what it was set at, tank design's important too. If you have a big boxy tank, that means in the middle of that tank it's a lot warmer than where your temperature probe is on the edge. So some of that involves tank design, and we talked about totes quite a bit. Well, not quite a bit, but we talked about totes a little bit, and you have no power over that with the tote. Unless you, they do make some cool things. You just hook up to glycol and you just stick them in there, and it's like a little plate. But still, then you're trying to take samples and keep your temperature, and that also requires someone being there like all the time. So yeah, low and slow, and get nice narrow tanks.
Got it. If you're, you don't want to be at 80, 95 degrees, then your yeast will get really unhappy. So by low, we mean like 60, or some people go in the 50s. Mm-hmm. You know, so do your fermentations either in a controlled temperature environment or wait till the winter. If you have a cold room at your farm, maybe do it in some there. If you can afford glycol and keep the fermenter at a certain temperature, that's the best.
I would pick up on what you said about, you know, just setting it for a 2 degree differential. If you're a beginning cider maker, I can't recommend more strongly measure every 1 or 2 days during your fermentation. So, you know what your starting specific gravity is, and watch it and track it. And you learn so much about fermentation dynamics by just watching what your patterns are with different yeasts or different fermentation, and you're measuring the temperature as well as the drop. And just being at one temperature doesn't mean that your fermentation is going at one rate, right? So you're naturally going to have a lot more activity early on, and then it's going to taper off. And we really find that we're trying to lower temperature at the beginning, or actually starting to raise it at the end. And a happy yeast fermentation is usually somewhere between 1 to 4 points of specific gravity drop a day. And if you're getting out of those bounds, you're getting too slow or too fast.
So when you say 1 to 4 points, right on the specific gravity scale,
yeah,
correct?
1.001 to 1.004. Like,
okay,
the
got it.
There.
Yeah. I'm with you. All right, thank you.
Well, I'm sad to say, like, we have reached the time limit for this seminar this morning. Although I know that, and I just want to reintroduce Ben Calvi. We have Brent Miles, Eleanor Leger, Tim Godfrey, Marcus Roberts. They're all going to be willing to chit-chat with you, whether right after this or at some other point. And just a kind of an ending thought, all the information you got, you're also kind of following your bliss. So keep the heart of cider in that mind, too. It's a worthy endeavor, and these kind of opportunities to talk, we probably could do this all day, so I hope we get to do it again at future cider cons. So thank you all for attending, and enjoy the rest of the sessions in CiderCon. This podcast is coming out on April 10th, and in 2 days' time, I'm going to be on the Monterey Bay Cider Tour, and you know it's going to be a totally cider experience. These cider tours are rolling out. This is the first one in 2017. The next one set up is in Normandy, France, the last week of September. Now is the time to get your reservations. Go to the Totally Cider page at ciderchat.com. And if you want to land early and go to the Luminaries exhibit in Paris, where they're doing like 3D experiences of Van Gogh and other artists, you could actually watch a video, this experience with the Luminaries. There is a link at the Cider Chat Facebook page. So contact me about that. We have some good rates right now for folks coming in early on the tour to stay at the hotel that's very close to the Arc de Triomphe. We're going to be finishing that cider tour at Palms, which is the cider restaurant with a Michelin bib. That's like Michelin star rating in Paris. They're super stoked. If you don't follow them on Instagram, you should. It's P-O-M-Z-E. Always bringing in tasting, always having like the best ciders that they could get in that entire region and beyond. It's a happening place. I'm looking forward to reaching down the ground, picking up a pear, and biting into it, and just having that juice experience. Listen to Americans in Paris if you want to hear some of that experience that the folks on last year's trip took. And I want to hug an ancient pear tree. You got to hug the trees. I mean, that's what it's about. And drinking the cider in Port A too. All right, I'm going to be rolling out of here. Got to get ready for the cider tours coming in to Capitola and rolling out on the Betty Jane. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Yeehaw!